Every team, every topic, everywhere. This is Believe.
William Joseph Hill is today's guest on Taekwondo Life Magazine Live. My name is Mark Sirianis. I'm your host. I'm a third Dan black belt, and I'm the editor-in-chief of Taekwondo Life Magazine. William Joseph Hill is a martial artist, lifelong martial artist. He is an actor. He has done television, film, commercial work. He is a content creator. And most recently, he is a first-time debut novelist. William Joseph Hill came to my attention for his debut book signing for his new book, Cyber Fighter, the first installment of a fictional martial arts sci-fi action-adventure trilogy at an event which was held at the Martial Arts History Museum in California. There are those of you who may remember Michael Matsudo, himself a martial artist and the founder of that museum, was one of the earliest guests that we had on this podcast. As martial artists, as Taekwondo practitioners, I know that for myself, we voraciously consume martial arts content. We love martial arts movies. We like to read martial arts magazines. And when we have the opportunity to pick up a exciting, engaging martial arts action novel, we do that as well. And this is written by a man who isn't writing through supposition about what he thinks about martial arts, but writing from experience. I enjoyed talking to him. I look forward to the unfolding of his exciting trilogy, and I hope you enjoy this program.
Okay, well, today we are speaking with William Joseph Hill. William is an actor, a writer, martial artist, and he came to my attention because he was doing a book signing for his new book at the Martial Arts History Museum in California. As those of you that may remember from a prior episode, we had the honor and the privilege to speak to Michael Matsuda, and we follow him very carefully, and last week, sometime there was a book signing there for William Joseph Hill's new book, Cyber Fighter. So, sir, thank you for joining us. We appreciate your time, and welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Yeah, Michael is so fantastic. It was such a wonderful event there at the Martial Arts History Museum. The book signing, so many family, friends, and fans that came out to support me. It was overwhelming. It was a really great experience.
Well, that's great, and I'm not surprised. And, yeah, we certainly are large fans of him and the work that he does, and the unbelievable way that he manages to promote cultural exchange and understanding of the martial arts and martial arts history. So, do you have a long-standing relationship with him, or is this the first interaction and event that you've done with Michael and with the museum?
Oh well, I've kind of known Michael a little bit more casually for the past few years. I've attended Dragon Fest for a few years. And then my wife, actually, I first met Michael when my wife, for my birthday, surprised me, took me to the museum, which I had no idea existed. You know, I've been doing martial arts my whole life, so it was kind of funny that this one slipped by me. But she always looks up for good things online to do, and she discovered it. And so I met Michael. He was so awesome. And it was really fascinating because, you know, he got a lot of his training in monkey style kung fu. And I had done a film where I did a cinematic version of monkey style, not authentic monkey kung fu, but a cinematic version of it, which was fun. So we kind of were able to connect on that respect. But yeah, Michael recently published his own book, and then he's always said to authors, he's always recommended, you know, especially if they're martial arts related, have you signing at the museum. And Pamela and I thought, wow, that's perfect location. And because we love the museum and love having it then, it's a way to kind of like get more exposure for him as well.
That's great. That is great. And that's certainly how it came to my attention. So, and I want to speak a little bit about the book, but let's roll back a little bit to the beginning for you in terms of your foray into the martial arts and martial arts training. Tell us a little bit about that. Where did you grow up?
I grew up, so I'm a Navy brat. My dad was in the Navy. So I was born in Rhode Island. So I'm a native New Englander, but I actually was raised in Southern California in Hawaii because he was stationed on ships. He was a destroyer captain. So we deployed a bunch and we were in Hawaii for 10 years. So I always say that that's where I really grew up because that was the longest chunk of time that I spent in my childhood. And we were stationed on Ford Island, which is in the middle of Pearl Harbor. It was the site of the 1941 attack. So it's a very historic place to grow up. And the house, our house was actually built in 1923. So it was there when the attack happened.
Oh, wow.
So there's like history all around me. And every day going to school, I'd have to take a ferry because they didn't build. Right now, there's a bridge that can take you over to Ford Island. They got a lot of tourist stuff there now. But when I was growing up there, it was just all military only, and you had to take a ferry. So you had to be in the military to get, or, you know, a dependent. And it was interesting because they actually started the karate school, the karate branch of a karate school on base at the base gymnasium on Ford Island, which was in an old airplane hangar from World War II that was converted into the gym. And now it's actually the Aviation Museum. So if you go there now on Ford Island, you visit Pearl Harbor, and you go to the Aviation Museum where they got all these airplanes from World War II and whatnot, a big museum in that hangar across from the red and white air tower, that is actually the location I began my martial arts journey.
Wow.
In the hangar, yeah. So it's kind of cool. In a way, it's like an indirect museum for me, too. But there's, you know,
sure,
you have to know the story behind it, yeah.
So how is it that you came to start to study martial arts? What was so you have that level of accessibility, but what was the draw for you for studying the martial arts? Was it something that your folks wanted you to become involved in, or was it something that you always wanted to do? Or was it from watching television? What was the draw?
Yeah, okay. So I'll have to rewind the tape just a few more years back. Before we moved to Hawaii, in sixth grade, we had like a sixth grade camp in the summer, and they had movie nights. And so what they would do is they would get 16-millimeter prints of like Hollywood movies, you know, third run. At that time, it was like second, third run. And one night they actually screened Enter the Dragon. And I had heard the name Bruce Lee growing up. I had, you know, friends of mine who had older brothers and stuff would drop his name left and right. And I'd be like, God, don't, that didn't register with me.
Sure.
And then I saw him actually on the big square screen because we had like a 60-millimeter print and him kicking and doing everything. And that whole scene in the beginning with the student where he's just like, it is like a finger pointing away to the moon, and he slaps him on the face and on the head. And it was just like, wow, I want to learn how to do that. So that kind of like piqued my interest. And from that moment on, it was kind of whenever I would see martial arts, I would be like, oh yeah, I want to learn it. And then the Karate Kid came out and we rented that on VHS and the next day in our mailbox was a flyer saying they're going to start a karate class up at that Ford Island gym. So I was like, Mom, can I take it? And she was like, sure. Yeah. And I was surprised because, you know, as a kid who always wants to do stuff, usually used to your parents saying no or
sure.
Well, maybe or this. And that. But she was just like, she was on board. I think, you know, I think because the movie was such a positive influence on the martial arts, it kind of like it was the perfect timing. So it was like, great.
Right. That's interesting. And those, you know, it's interesting because in terms of the influence, particularly of people that are probably a little bit today, you know, there's a lot more exposure to martial arts through a number of different places. And the availability and accessibility is a lot greater, certainly, than when I started. But probably two of the most significant and influential pieces of media in terms of getting people to become involved in the martial arts are the two that you just mentioned, and you happen to have both of them, sort of one into the other, right? With Enter the Dragon, for a whole generation of folk, really was essential. It was really the key piece of media that got folks involved. And The Karate Kid is probably, again, one of the greatest upticks in people's interest in martial arts. So that's very, very interesting that both of those were part and parcel of your, you know, your journey. Now, in terms of style and in terms of your involvement, it obviously you said it was as a result of getting a flyer saying that, you know, there was a karate school. But in terms of style and your choice of style, was that was simply the basis of it? Was there any understanding at that time for you of distinction of style, what karate was, what taekwondo was, what kung fu was, or was it simply a matter of the fact that it was all martial arts for you going into it as it is for so many of us?
Oh, it's so funny. I have to share this story because it was interesting. After I had started taking classes there, my mom was like, you know, Bill, I have to share this with you. I'm like, what, Mom? She's like, when we first moved on the island, they were going to have a taekwondo class, and they were looking for the parents to sign up, anybody interested. So she signed me and my brothers up, and we were the only people that really cared about a taekwondo class. The rest of the island, I don't know, they were apathetic or something, or they just didn't sign up, so they didn't have it. So I was like, wait, you mean I couldn't learn taekwondo when I...
That's hysterical.
Yeah, because I'm like, you know, I was always attracted to the kicks, and so even though I got my training, the style that was there that was on Fort Island was Okinawan Kenpo. And to me, I was like, karate's karate, except that we wore black gi. So I was kind of like, oh, I'm used to the white gi. Well, I guess black's better
because sure.
It doesn't get dirty as easy. But, you know, and then people would be confused, like, are you talking about Ed Parker's Kenpo? And I say, no, it's more of a traditional Okinawan style of Kenpo
sure.
and stuff like that. So style-wise, it was like, it was a matter of convenience then. But, you know, as your martial journey continues and you meet people from other styles and you're like, I want to learn that kick. And so I had a lot of friends who did taekwondo, especially when I moved here to Los Angeles and started pursuing film and television work. A lot of my martial arts friends, they were all taekwondo black belts. So they
sure.
kicked like fantastic and their kicks are beautiful. I'm like, I need to learn how to do that. And so I would steal their, you know, steal the moves from them. Like, oh, okay. And I'm a natural southpaw. So I mean, I have to learn everything on my left side and then translate it to the right side. But, yeah, it was funny. You know, when you're in cinema and you're a performer, you kind of like learn maybe not the authentic real styles, but enough of like that. I call it the cinematic style to where you can
sure.
look like you're doing it on screen. Like I got my SAG card on a Hebrew National commercial where I did Tai Chi. So the audition
oh, wow.
was like they wanted people to come in and do Tai Chi, and I'm like, well, I dabbled in it, but as far as like, could I tell you really Yang style or Chin style? No, but I at least know the names and I know the opening moves. I'm like, yeah, just do a couple of that, and they were like, great, looks good. So, you know, a lot of producers are not really well versed in the martial arts, so they're just like looking for somebody who looks good enough on screen to pull it off, and that's all you need to do. Unless, of course, you're doing a stunt fight, and then that's a completely different
sure.
skill.
Sure, and it's interesting, and you raise a good point, and I think a lot of this has changed, and probably for the better. But when we had interviewed Stephen Lambert, who stuntman, extraordinary stuntman,
oh, yeah.
and he had done
yes, he
a number of things, but one of the things he had done is, I think, an episode of Fantasy Island, and it had called for somebody who was proficient in kung fu, and all of the things that they had were related to karate, and he sort of educated them, I think, on the distinction between kung fu and karate. And it was just amazing to him how little they, you know, they wanted to work the martial arts theme into the program, but really didn't have any real understanding of it at all, even from the standpoint of the writers. And then later on, he talked a lot about the struggles of he ended up getting permission to stunt for some of the women because there were just not enough female martial artists, stunt women at the time. And he was the only person who was available and who was skilled and was able to do all the things that he did. So it's really interesting to see some of the progression of that to some of the real greater understanding that the public has and that cinema people have regarding the martial arts. So tell me a little bit about your journey. You use the term martial journey, which I love. Tell me about your martial journey. So you got involved. You had this interest. You went and started studying karate. And where does that lead? How long do you do that before you turn to other styles? And how does that lead into what it is that you do for a living?
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of people, when they start in the martial art, especially like a karate style or taekwondo that has a belt system, a lot of people are like, I want to get the black belt. And it was funny because, like, when I remember my first lesson was, like, July 2nd. So it was, like, right before the 4th of July weekend. I was just like, I just wanted to learn. I mean, the belt thing was kind of cool. I was happy having a white belt, too. I was like, oh, this is cool. I got an actual belt, and I had to learn how to tie it. And I spent my first couple of days going over and over. Once the senpai showed me how to tie it, I was just like, oh, okay, I got to practice till I could do it without, you know, thinking about it. And so, like, my first week, I was like, I mastered the belt time just because I practiced it so much. So to me, it was like I wanted to learn how to be good. And I think because my whole life, too, I wanted to be a filmmaker, and so I'm doing that as well. So I always had this eye on definitely martial arts, part performance art, and then also part, you know, self-defense and fitness and all that other stuff, which kind of came out of it. But there was always this love for, like, being able to physically do something that not everybody can do. And, like, back when breakdancing and popping was popular, I was doing that, too. And, with that, you're kind of self-taught. So the first few years, I'm not good at it. and then you get this thing where, like, you pass puberty and you're, like, in the middle of, like, your adolescence, and then you're kind of like, oh, okay, you get your coordination on, and then all of a sudden it became easier. And then I think it also helped when I started karate training as well, to kind of, like, just, I was just like a sponge. I just wanted to learn whatever they were teaching me. I was just like, I wasn't questioning anything. To me, I didn't understand styles so much as that, oh, it's a different school and stuff. And then I would see the kata is different. And then I'd see, hey, the Taekwondo guys, their punches looked a lot like some of our kata and stuff. And then you realize, sure, oh yeah, it all kind of comes from the same origin, but as it's diversified, you know, everything becomes its own thing. And so it's a matter of, you know, my style in Hawaii, they were very big on traditional competition too. So a lot of times the forms that we didn't really do too much bunkai or what the form means and stuff.
Sure.
It was kind of like more for the aesthetics or for the tournaments. Cause my senpai, a lot of the upper black belts, they were like winning trophies left and right. Cause they were really, really good. And especially with their point fighting, they were very fast. And I was like, I was not that good in point fighting, and it frustrated me. So I started doing full contact on my own. And basically, you know, the same gym that I began my training at, I ended up getting a job there, like my first job. And so when I would run the gym, I'd meet these Marines and Navy SEALs that would actually come and work out. And the ones that'd see me hitting on the bag, and they'd go, oh, you got some, yeah, let's spar. And, you know, I had 12-ounce boxing gloves and some headgear, and say, okay, sure. And a lot of the Marines were, like, untrained, and so they try to hit you, sure, as hard as they could. And you would learn very quickly, hey, this punch and kick is not as effective as I thought, until you, like, you know, get tired of showing control. And, okay, then you got to hit them one time and knock the wind out of one of them, and then they don't want to play anymore. And it's kind of, that's not fair. It's like they like beating up on you, but as soon as you hit back, it's like, I'm done.
Right, all right. That's interesting, yeah. And it's a great opportunity on your end to evolve your training into the practical applications, and be able to discern what works and what doesn't work for the purpose of being able to really, really grow your style.
Yeah.
Let me ask you one question that sort of maybe isn't apparent is, so you came from a military background, and you were,
yes,
in a military surrounding. Was that ever something that you had contemplated, or that was never part of where your mindset was in terms of where you wanted to develop your own path?
I think before I realized, and it was very, very young, I think the original Star Wars movie came out, and I saw that. And then when I found out that, hey, people actually do that as a job, then I was like going, I want to do that. But before then, I think, you know, as a kid, very young kid, I didn't understand that, you know, having a dad in the Navy was a rare thing. I figured everybody's kid, you know,
sure,
wore a khaki uniform and went off to a ship until I realized, no, that's kind of weird and unique and kind of different. And I was kind of like, oh. And I think, I always joked about, like, yeah, the family business was the military, and I just didn't go into the family business because I have a brother who's in the Coast Guard, and then I have another brother who works with the Navy. So, yeah, the military is, like, it's in my blood, but I always wanted to go to Hollywood. So I was,
sure,
like, I'd rather play a Navy SEAL than be a Navy SEAL. So.
Sure, sure. That's great. So that's interesting. So tell me about that. Tell me, how does your journey into, you know, you're in the middle of studying the martial arts, and you're,
yeah,
in this environment in Hawaii. How does that transition into your foray into the entertainment industry?
Well, interestingly enough, coinciding with my martial journey was also my filmmaker's journey. I started making movies roughly about the same time I began training. So I finally conned my mother into letting me use the Super 8 camera for my first couple. And then after a while, I realized how expensive film was. And then I said, hey, wait, VHS is cheap. So
sure.
In high school, I actually, I like to say conned, but no, I really didn't really con them because I really thought it was cool. The head of the AV department actually let me borrow the school's video camera so that I could film a ninja movie with my sister and brothers. I'm the oldest of five, so I had a built-in cast that I could count on. And then a neighborhood kid
that
was like other ninjas.
That is something we have in common. I'm one of five as well, and we did all the same kind of things. That's great.
Yep. So that's kind of how that started. And I realized quickly, like, what's a low-budget ninja costume? Because the ninja costumes, even back in the day of the magazines, it was still, you're still paying $40 for a whole set. And then you have kids. It's like, well, that's not going to fit. But then I realized, oh, you have a dark T-shirt. Turn it inside out to hide the logos. You use the where you stick the neck through. You got your little visor and then tie the sleeves behind your head. And there you go. You got a ninja mask.
That's great. Whatever the imagination will, and a little ingenuity, right, will lend itself. Well, that's great.
Yeah.
So how does that go from making, how does that transition from being creative and acting and producing and directing VHS films in your backyard into a professional career? How does that transition happen?
So I knew when my dad retired, our family, we had a residence down in San Diego, and he was going to return when he retired. And so at the time I graduated college, I decided I want to go back to San Diego because it's a lot easier to come up to Los Angeles from San Diego than to buy a plane ticket from Hawaii.
Sure.
So instead of staying in Hawaii, I kind of came back with the family, stayed in San Diego for a few years, began professionally training as an actor down there in some acting classes. And then I started auditioning up in LA. And at some point, the mileage was just killing me. And then I realized I got to make the move. And then once I made the move, you know, my dad was like, well, shouldn't you wait till you have a gig? And I'm like, Dad, if I don't go out, I won't make the networking connections and meet people. That's kind of how you build gigs. And it's so true. You kind of like have to be there
sure.
to do it. So, but all the while, like pursuing, you know, acting, you know, you're going out on normal commercial auditions or film and television auditions, and you're not always getting called in for martial arts roles. Because a lot of times when I would submit myself back in the days of Dramalog and you mail it in, they'll call you in and they basically line you up with all the other big buff guys and said, well, as a Caucasian guy, you kind of have to be pretty tall and pretty buff. Because I have more of like the physique of Bruce Lee, but I'm not Asian. So it's kind of like, yeah, you're a little too small to be the white guy. So they're the
right,
big,
sure.
muscular, you know, the Scott Adkins looking guys. And I'm like, yeah, that's not me.
Right.
Adkins can move and he can kick. And it's like, oh, yeah, I don't think no, because he's in England. So I didn't get a chance to try to go up against him. There's no way I would have been able to do anything. But I mean, watching some of those, but like TJ Storm and all those other guys who are like really big in the industry now. TJ Storm, I remember auditioning a couple of his projects way back in the day. Now he does a lot of motion capture, which is fantastic. And you know, it's such a small knit community, but so many of the guys that I would hang with and do martial arts and stuff, they were professional stunt guys. And because of they not only did like a more acrobatic style like a Taekwondo, especially, but they would also, a lot of the schools out here, either they incorporated into the curriculum or these people just like took classes in gymnastics as well. So they're already doing tumbling and handsprings and something like, oh yeah, I skipped that one. So I'm not
sure.
doing all the aerial flips and stuff, but yeah, it's some impressive stuff that they could do. But at some point I would work out with a bunch of guys that were making their own independent films. And I, you know, they really liked me a lot because I'm very comedic and I look a lot like Jim Carrey. So that was kind of like a big selling point for me because at the time, In Living Color was huge and Jim Carrey actually had launched his film career. And so he was like the big thing in the 90s. So I'm like, yeah, I kind of look like Jim. And they're like, yeah, you do. And then I'm like, hey, maybe we should do like a vehicle where, you know, something that around like somebody like a character I could play. And he's like, well, I don't have one. Do you have anything? And I'm like, well, no, but I could write one. And so that's where I first wrote the script for Cyber Fighter, the book. So it started off as actually a feature film screenplay.
Wow. So tell me about let's make the transition, and we could always go back to some of the other stuff. And I wanted to talk to you, of course, about Scorpio Productions. But tell me about this. This is exciting, and you know, there are a number of martial arts books that are out there, but certainly most of them are either biographical, autobiographical, or they are of the basis of their technique based, right? Pumse
yeah.
books or sparring books. When I saw that there was a new book out and it had a martial arts theme, and that it was a work of fiction, sci-fi, martial arts, action, adventure, a little bit of comedy, Cyber Fighter, it really struck my interest. So tell me a little bit about this. How does that screenplay make its foray into this novel? And then tell us about certainly where we can find it and what the future holds in terms of this book.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, so the first – so when we're going back to my filmmaker friend and saying, like, well, do you have a project or you have a script? I'm like, oh, I could write one. And so I'm like, oh, great. Now I got to write myself something. I'd written scripts before and stuff, but this was like the first time I was like, oh, somebody's actually going, oh, write something. I'm like, okay, great. So the first thing brainstorming was like, okay, I knew it was a martial art. I want to do the martial art thing. And so I write down every potential martial art plot, you know, the tournament movie, the, you know, the blood sport movie, or like with Chuck Norris, it's always a cop movie. And then I'm like, or you have the, like the Karate Kid where they're learning the martial arts. And I'm like, okay, well, that has the most character growth, character arc. So I'm like going, okay. But I'm like going, yeah, but they did the Karate Kid. And then I realized at the time, this was in 1999, so The Matrix had come out. And I was like, ah, yeah. So what if he learns martial arts really fast? And I'm like, okay, well, The Matrix did that. I'm like, okay, so how do I put a spin on that? Whereas in The Matrix, Neo was a Superman and had all these abilities inside the Matrix. And then in the real world, he was just a schlub. So instead, I kind of came up with this idea, okay, well, what if they're actually programming your brain, like, and your neurons? So they hook up all these electrodes to you and they're stimulating your muscles to learn the muscle movements and you're like under for like 72 hours. It's like a lucid dream. And when you wake up, you know, 47 different styles of martial arts. So I'm like, oh, okay. Put that at the time, it sounded far-fetched. Not so much anymore now, apparently. It's kind of like turning into science fact, which is kind of like, whoa.
Sure, sure.
But that was the initial genesis of, like, the idea. And that was a basic concept. The original draft of the script, I think, was just, like, less than 90 pages. So it was very short, very sparse. But over the years, rewriting and writing it, and then having people who are interested in coming on board as producers, having pulled off to other projects or – because this one, I always intended of doing it independently instead of trying to sell to a studio because I wanted to be in it. So I knew that I had to do it myself. And this was
sure.
before they had crowdfunding, before YouTube even existed. So it was kind of like back then when I did a breakdown for how much it was going to cost a lot of money because you had to shoot it on film. And even though digital cinema was just starting back then, if you wanted anything, even in a festival, it's like you had to shoot it on film or you had to do a film print at some point, which is a huge cost. So it's kind of like, in ways, it's taken this long just because of the technology had to catch up with the vision. And then over the years, the script going through, the story expanded, and I had a few script readings with a lot of great feedback. The last time I had a big script reading, public reading of it, I think one of the big comment that I had, I think, was in essence, like I had 10 pounds of potatoes in a 5-pound bag. So the story was so big that people were like losing it. So then I realized, well, I think I have a trilogy here. And then back in 2014, I finalized the feature script and then I pulled it out, I think, a few years later at the time when Ready Player One came out in the movie theater. And I realized that was based on a novel. And then it occurred to me, oh, maybe I should just take the screenplay and actually turn it into a novel and self-publish it on Amazon. Because at the time, I think the guy who wrote The Martian, he actually self-published. And
yeah.
he actually, his first like few chapters he released on his blog. And I was like, okay, well, that's cool. Andy Weir, I think is his name, really, who wrote The Martian. But it was like, oh, that. So it kind of made me click and go, okay, well, I never try. And it's funny because with the screenplay, you have to be very minimal in what you're describing. So
sure.
Adverbs and adjectives are your enemy. You don't want to use any modifiers. You want to keep it basic, simple, a lot of white space. And then a novel, I always thought, I don't know if I can write a novel because you've got to expand on it. But then once I knew the structure, because I just take the screenplay out and go, this is the structure of the story. Now all I get to do is elaborate, go into everybody's head, talk about their thoughts, this whole thing. And next thing you know, it just flowed. And it was just like, oh, that was fantastic. So I spent about a year just writing the original draft of the manuscript. And then another year just going through and editing it down to the final version, which I published on Amazon. And Amazon is great because they have these tools that let you, like you want to self-publish it, you can format the Kindle and the paperback using their same software. I think it's Kindle Create software. You download your computer and you upload your Word document, and then you can just edit in there. And it's like, it's fantastic.
Well, that is great. That is great. And it is a testament to your tenacity and your persistence. I mean, the ability to do this type of writing, whether it be screenplay writing or novel writing, both very unique skill sets, and to be able to do that and transition from one to the other is certainly a testament to your patience and your desire to your passion to get this project off the ground. So tell me about now that it is it has now come to you're out there in the world, you've thrown it out to the world. How has the reception been for Cyberfighter? What's your feeling on it now, and where do we go from here with it? Well, what is next for it? Will there be the movie version? Will there be sequels? What can we expect from it? And tell us a little bit of a little bit about the plot itself in terms of, I know that you've talked a little bit about, I love this concept, right, of what if you could become a black belt of multiple styles in 72 hours. But is it something that is self-contained within this one version, or does it lend itself to a series?
Oh, yeah, thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah, it's so this actual book is the first of the trilogy. And the story is, you know, as I've been writing it and as I developed this thing over the years, I started to really, and I love science and science fiction, and I watch a lot of YouTube, a lot of stuff on psychology and science and things like that, and a lot of stuff about the brain too. And it's fascinating. There's a fascinating series on YouTube that's given by this one, Michael Stevens, who's like the host of Vsauce. He has this thing called what is it called? It's a brain. I can't even think of it. So my brain's turned off right now. But it's all about the mind. Mind Field. That's what it's called. Mind Field.
Yes,
mind
yes.
Field, but Mind Field. Fantastic series. So as I'm developing this, I'm starting to realize that there are greater, you know, the story's developing more into like, what is consciousness really? And what is the actual soul? And in the second and third book, of course, and then movies, it's going to go into that, because the funny thing is, like, so this is Brian, you know, the main character. He volunteers for this experiment. He's actually a semi out of work temping former video game designer who takes a temp job at a defense contractor where they con him into volunteering for this experiment. So he thinks he's like beta testing like cool software, like an Unreal Engine or like an immersive 3D. Like Vader Unleashed type of, like, you put the Oculus on and you're like in this environment, but they actually program him with all of these skills and stuff. And then they do a pitch for the Pentagon and DARPA, and DARPA and the Pentagon love it, and they decide they're going to deploy him. And so Brian has to make his escape because that wasn't part of his plan, even though he signed the contract without really reading it. So you've got the U.S. government that's out after him. And then meantime, halfway across the world, a triad gang boss, Lao Xiaoming, has this idea. He has his own little program called Project Starfish, which, no spoilers, but it's the world domination type of thing, you know, like these crazy maniacal despotic wannabe emperors have in their mind. So he realizes that this technology is the key to seeing his thing off. So he hacks into it and does a little something that kind of like involves him, and all of the baddies that he's in charge of all of a sudden want me too. So I'm being pursued all over the place by the FBI, the U.S. Army, the triads, and everybody. So it's just like this big international comical, and in a way it's kind of like a commentary on the military-industrial complex too, a little bit, kind of poking fun at everything like that. But because I'd actually temped at defense companies and stuff, so it's kind of like, yeah, I'd see all this stuff, and I'm like, write what you know.
No, you know what? I was just as you almost took the words out of my mouth. I think that so much of writings and film and screenplays and things that are successful come from a desire to take the basis of it are things that we know and we understand and that we can talk comfortably about, and then of course we expand on it and we expound on it and fictionalize it. But it comes from a place where it has legitimacy and people can relate to it, because they come to understand that, wow, this person's giving me a real insight into a part of the world that they know a lot about, but I don't really know anything about. And it sounds to me like there's a lot of that in this novel. So very, very exciting, and I look forward to following the journey and to see what happens with it as you continue to treat us with additional installments. So I know that you said that I know you're heavily promoting this edition now, but you did say that it's a trilogy. Do we have a potential release date down the road for volumes 2 and 3, or is that sort of up in the air, or is that something that's relatively scheduled at this point?
It's going to be down the line. Right now, what I am immediately working on along with this is I'm doing an audiobook. In fact, I just started recording, and I'm just starting to edit and master the first few chapters that I've already recorded. So I'm in the process of that, which that should be released on Audible pretty soon as I can get that out. And then I'm also working on, of course, my intention is kind of like, growing up with Star Wars is my big inspiration. It's like, I have the Star Wars book, which actually came out like before the movie came out. So I'm like, oh, okay, so this is good timing. I want to do the feature film. And one of the ways that I'm going to manifest that is I'm doing a short film version of it. When my character goes into the program, it's all CG animation. And I've actually already done all of that. I did a sneak preview of part of the animated sequence in the short film at the book signing, which everybody really loved that. They were fantastic. Because I had a video. Michael had his Blu-ray player with a huge screen. It was almost as big as like a multiplex cinema. So it was like a really good screen, and the sound sounded great, which is very important whenever you're screening something.
Sure, sure.
And it went over really great. So all that I need to do is raise the funding for the live action portion, which of course is going to have a lot of the fights and all the, the live action aspect of it. And that's what I'm going to be working on simultaneously. And then I think once those show that they have legs and people are interested in it, of course, the next movie. It's funny because I know where the story is going to end. I'm still got to map out how I got to get there. And it's kind of funny because sometimes you know the germ of the idea, and you might know what the ending's going to be, and then you got to go, okay, now I got to justify, right, to kind of justify that. And I think there's a few different directions that it could be going. I have a rough sketch of what the second book and the second film is going to be all about, but in a way, it's kind of like, I always say, the second act, it's like going to get a little bit darker, but not too dark, because I still like the comedic elements. I was really heavily influenced by Monty Python growing up, and Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is a funny sci-fi thing. So there's a little bit of that tongue-in-cheek thing in this book too.
Well, that's great. That's great. And as we're sort of winding down in terms of time, but I wanted to hit on, and I think it's sort of related, tell us a little bit about Four Scorpio Productions. Tell me what that is. How does that tie in? And what is the relationship between that and this book?
Okay. Four Scorpio Productions is actually my wife and I. We shortly after we got married, her brother, actually, who dabbled a little bit in astrology, he actually did our birth charts, and he found that combined we had four major planets in the constellation Scorpio, which I'm not sure I understand all the aspects of that, but it sounded really cool. And then shortly after that, I realized, hey, we should have a production company, and we should call it Four Scorpio Productions because it's our company together. And we kind of sat on that for a few years. While I always said that Cyber Fighter was the flagship production. So over the years, as we've been going through turnaround and revisions and all this other stuff, that was always on the burner. And then I think about 2016, we started just doing our own short films because we had camera and I had filmmaking skills. And I'm like, you know, with YouTube, because we had a YouTube channel, we got part of the YouTube partnership program because back in 2009, I did a video that went viral. It was Obama had just been elected, and Obama's from Hawaii. And I grew up in Hawaii, yeah. So there's a specific way that they talk in Hawaii that called Pidgin English, which apparently is not so much anymore. But when I was a kid there, it was big. Everybody would talk like this, back in the time, let it. So what I did was I did a video of Obama talking Pidgin, but of course it's his voice and it's kind of his stuff light up, and people loved it or they hated it. They really hated it. They loved it, and they would comment, and it got me like almost 500,000 views. YouTube comes and knocking and says, hey, you want to be part of the partnership program for ad revenue? I'm like, sure. And so that's how we get our channel started. And in 2015 we start like making short films, and one of the short films we did was we did this little parody of the 60s, 70s, like sitcoms, like a Brady Bunch or Bewitched or That Girl, all that stuff, with a laugh track. And I had to use my Bruce Lee wig to give myself some hair so that I looked like I had 70s hair. And we called it That Darn Girlfriend. And the pilot episode was just like this cheesy little thing, like, you know, the boyfriend comes back in his three-piece business suit, 1970 suit, and he's just like, honey, that plane ticket you booked for me, it was supposed to be for Paris, France. You made it for Paris, Texas. And it's like this uh-oh and the laugh track. And then there's a little song that my wife Pamela wrote and a little jingle, and she does that. And we have like little credits with little cartoons and kind of like the old 1960s stuff. And everybody loved it. And they said, when's the next episode? And I'm like, oh, I guess we should make this a series. So we did. We're currently in the second season of that. And we basically produce episodes of That Darn Girlfriend, usually like maybe once every 1-2 months. Usually we've got an idea will hit us, and then we'll brainstorm it, go into production on that. And within a week of shooting it, it only takes about a week of post-production, and then we've got it released on YouTube. But yeah, it was like season one was 12 episodes, and right now we just recently released episode 4 of season 2, which is everyone loved this one because it's called Magic to Do.
Well, that is great. That is great, and we will look for that, and we'll post that in our show notes. So it sounds to me like you, William Joseph Hill, you have a lot going on, very creative, very upbeat, and very, very exciting to have come to our awareness. And I'm really happy to share a little bit of your journey and a little bit about what's going on with you with our audience. I know that your book is available now at Amazon.com and other places. Where else can they find that? Any place basically that books are sold, correct? Where they can find Cyber Fighter?
Actually, I am exclusive to Amazon. So if you just go to Amazon.com, you can order it as either paperback or Kindle version, whichever one you prefer. Some people they love the e-books because they're so portable.
Sure.
And other people like, I mean, I like a paperback myself, but ebook is, yeah. But ebooks are great, like if you're on a plane trip or something like that,
sure.
And you don't have room in your luggage, but you can carry on, you can carry your Kindle, and now I think they have it like you can even read them on your tablet too. So if you got an iPad or something, you can read as well. But yeah, it's an exclusive thing with Amazon, because I'm thinking like, yeah, you know, if the short film is a hit and the books are a hit, I can always go, hey, Jeff Bezos, Amazon Studios might want to produce this.
Absolutely. There's certainly a big outlet there. So, well, that is
for
great.
Sure.
We're gonna link the buying. We'll post the Amazon buying link in the show notes. And it really has been a pleasure speaking with you. You are involved in so many different things. And like I said, as soon as I saw that you were doing something with Michael Matsuda, and I saw a little bit about what that project was, I knew that you would be an interesting guest for our audience and somebody that I would really love to speak to. So I thank you so much for your patience. This call got off a little later than we had expected today because I had some technological problems, and you were so gracious, and I certainly do appreciate that. I wanted to give you an opportunity to tell our audience where they can follow you. Again, we are going to post some of these things, but where they can find out what's going on with you in the days after we post this episode and in the upcoming years. What would be the best place for people to follow your career, whether that be the website or social media, on YouTube? What would be the best place for them to find out more about what's happening in the life of William Joseph Hill?
Oh, thank you so much, Mark. It's been a pleasure speaking to you as well. I have a website, williamjosephhill.com. Pretty easy, but just as it's spelled, so there's two H's in there. My social media links are there as well, but if you look me up on Twitter, my Twitter handle is @4Scorpio, F-O-U-R-S-C-O-R-P-I-O, like 4 Scorpio Productions. My Instagram is William Joseph Hill, so you can easily spot me once you see the cyber fighter brand, and you're like, oh, okay, this is definitely him. With the shaved head, kind of Jim Carrey looking guy with the shaved head, looks like Fire Marshal Bill now, but that's my Instagram. And Facebook, there's a Facebook cyber fighter page too, which I'm going to start, especially as we get closer to like the crowdfunding campaign. I've been working on a lot of really cool digital rewards. I'm doing a digital book with all the artwork over the 20 years, telling the entire story of like the inception and showing some of my early concept art. I'm creating these digital trading cards that look like, you remember the old top Star Wars cards? They kind of look like that.
Sure.
So they're all digital too, because hey, it's cyber fighter, might as well have cyber rewards. But so if you go to Facebook and look up cyber fighter, that cyber fighter page, you can be sure to like that, because I'm going to start posting a lot more on that as things start to really ramp up here. And then also 4Scorpio.com is our production company, and that's FourScorpio.com too. So if you want to check that out. With all of our other projects, I think we have links to all of our That Darn Girlfriend. You can also see that show on YouTube. So if you just go YouTube and you Google and YouTube, you search for That Darn Girlfriend, and you see the pink thumbnails with the little cartoon characters, that's it. It's not animated, but that's part of our branding. And so you easily spot it that way.
Well, that is great. That is great. So William Joseph Hill, we wish you all success in the upcoming year. We're going to post all of this information on our show notes. We'll be following and looking closely. And as your projects come to light, we'll be highlighting them on our Facebook page and on our website, and looking forward to seeing the evolution of your life and career and the evolution of your exciting work, Cyberfighter. So thank you so much for talking to us today, and we wish you all the best.
Oh, thank you, Mark. And as we say in Hawaii, mahalo nui loa, which is thank you very much. It's been a pleasure talking to you as well.
My pleasure.
With spending time in training and working on the podcast and the magazine, it is difficult for me sometimes to get out to the store or the supermarket. And when that occurs, I always rely on Instacart. A friend of mine introduced me to Instacart about a year ago, and it has really changed the way that I shop. I go on the computer or on my phone. I have multiple stores to choose from in the neighborhood. I can select all of my products for delivery, and it'll give me other alternative products based upon my preferences. And it's really, really a helpful tool towards making your life a heck of a lot easier No more worrying about trying to find parking at the supermarket or standing in line at the checkout counter. You can just do all of it from your computer. It'll help you save money by giving you suggestions on deals and by providing you alternative products. And shoppers will hand select your products. They'll bag them up neatly, and that they'll deliver them within a specified delivery window. I have never had a problem with the products, the groceries, or the service from Instacart. And if you follow the show notes and you let Instacart know that we sent you, they'll provide you free delivery on your first order of over $35. I highly recommend it. And I think that it, for me, has been one of the life-changing services that I've gotten involved with. I'm not a guy who does a lot of internet shopping, but this is something I don't like to be without.
Thank you for listening to Believe. You can show support to your host by subscribing to the show and giving us a 5-star rating on your preferred platform. Check us out at Believe.com and search for BLEAV on YouTube.